Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the Wyndham Hotel in downtown San Jose. I am Denise Carter, president of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley Advisory Council and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome the listeners of KLIV AM 1590 in San Jose, California. We invite all our listeners to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. A little bit about our speaker. Throughout his public career, John McCain has been a leader in the most critical issues facing the country. He has waged a determined and often solitary campaign against pork barrel spending, fighting for 10 years to pass a line item veto. He has been a persistent proponent of lower taxes, genuine deregulation, and free trade. He has become one of Congress's most respected voices for a strong national defense and for a sound foreign policy. He has been an outspoken advocate for the reform of government institutions, and he has led a principled fight to change a campaign finance system that favors the interests of a special few over the needs of the majority. He is also considered one of the leading defenders of the rights of Native Americans. John McCain was first elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1982. As a long admirer of Ronald Reagan, McCain was an early foot soldier in the Reagan Revolution. He served two terms in the House before he was elected in the Senate in 1986. He was reelected to the third Senate term in November of 1998. In that election, he received nearly 70% of the vote, a total which included 65% of the women's vote, 55% of the Hispanic vote, and even 40% of the Democrats. Senator McCain is chairman of the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, and has, in that capacity, become a recognized leader on telecommunications and aviation issues, stressing the need to promote competition and government deregulation in the industries that are so important to the growth of our economy. Senator McCain has received numerous awards from taxpayer and foreign policy organizations for his distinguished public service and conservative leadership. In 1997, he was named one of the 25 most influential people in America by Time magazine. The son and grandson of prominent Navy admirals, John McCain was born in Panama Canal Zone in 1936. After graduating from the United States Naval Academy in 1958, McCain became a 22-year career, began a 22-year career as a naval aviator. In 1967, he was shot down over Vietnam and held as a prisoner of war in Hanoi for 5.5 years, much of it in solitary confinement. The story of McCain's imprisonment is eloquently told in Robert Timberg's The Nightingale Song. He retired from the Navy as a captain in 1981. McCain's naval honors include the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, Legion of Merit, Purple Heart, and Distinguished Flying Cross. Senator McCain has 7 children and 4 grandchildren. He and his wife, Cindy, reside in Phoenix. At a time when America searches for heroes to lead us, it has the genuine article in John McCain. His life is a testament to true courage, integrity, and leadership. John McCain has always put America's interest ahead of his own. Now this remarkable American looks ahead to his greatest challenge yet as he runs for presidency. Please welcome John McCain, candidate for president.
Thank you, Denise, and thank you for that kind, extended introduction. I thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity of being here. And I'd like to, first of all, say that it's always a pleasure for someone from the great state of Arizona to come to California to visit our water, which you have stolen from us now for for many years. I humbly beseech you to send it back. We have We have so little water in Arizona, the trees chase the dogs, and so I would very much appreciate a return of it. It's a great pleasure for me to be here with you all. Why, do I look bad already? Look like I'm going to faint or something, Roberta? I'm sorry. Okay, thank you. Okay, I thought, Roberta, Roberta usually hands speakers vodka instead of, I want to thank you. It makes much more eloquent speeches, I know, Roberta. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be with you. Thank you for the kind introduction. I must correct a couple of points, and that is that I'd like to remind you that it doesn't take a great deal of talent to get shot down. I was able to intercept a surface-to-air missile with my own airplane, which was Robert Strange McNamara's way of winning the Vietnam War. Barry Goldwater was my campaign chairman in 1986 when I ran to succeed him, and on election night he got rather nostalgic, and he said, you know, John, if I had been elected president in 1964 and defeated Lyndon Johnson, you'd have never spent all those years in a Vietnamese prison camp. I said, you're right, Barry, it would have been a Chinese prison camp. And he was not amused by that. I find running for president a very interesting and exciting experience. First, I seek your sympathy because we have a unique problem in Arizona. Barry Goldwater from Arizona ran for President of the United States. Morris Udall from Arizona ran for President of the United States. Bruce Babbitt from Arizona ran for President of the United States. Arizona may be the only state in America where mothers don't tell their children that someday they can grow up and be President of the United States. I'm going to the great state of New Hampshire again, by coincidence, on Tuesday. It's a very interesting experience. One of the funny men and great men I've ever known was Morris Udall. And I, quote, use his jokes all the time, but I am kind enough most of the time, not always, to credit him for the jokes. And campaigning in New Hampshire is epitomized by his joke where he said, a guy in Nashua, New Hampshire, said to the other guy in Nashua, New Hampshire in 1976 when Mo was running, said, what do you think about Mo Udall for president of the United States? And the guy says, I don't know. I only met him twice. And, you know, it's amusing, but it's also true about the people in New Hampshire. Some brave souls have already been to three town hall meetings that I have had, a degree of masochism that requires some kind of mental help. But my other favorite Mo Udall joke is Mo Udall walked into a barbershop in Manchester, New Hampshire, and said, hi, I'm Morris Udall from Arizona, and I'm running for president of the United States. And the barber said, yeah, we were just laughing about that this morning. And I might add, he also had one more where he said, the disease, the presidential fever is a disease that gets into the bloodstream and can only be cured by embalming fluid. And I also think that's true. I'm happy to be with you. I'd like to discuss just a couple of three issues. I have found recently, actually not recently, I used to start out town hall meetings in New Hampshire with a great 20-minute speech. I now speak for 5 minutes in New Hampshire and let people ask questions. I'll speak for a little more than 5 minutes to you, but I find that audiences would rather hear for me to hear your questions, respond to your questions and what's on your mind, and hear your comments and sometimes insults in the case of any former Marines who might be here, as opposed to hearing a long speech from me. Let me just say, this is a very exciting time to be alive and an American. It's a very exciting time to be in Silicon Valley. And it's a very exciting time to be in the Silicon Valleys all over America, which have sprung up outside of Dulles Airport, Austin, Texas, Boston, Massachusetts. There are many, and there will be more in America. And although much of the trail was blazed here in Silicon Valley, there is little ones all over America, and I'm very happy about it, some not so little. Why am I so excited? Because we are literally in a time where the world is changing. And sometimes we get so close to this incredible technology that we sometimes neglect its implications. Politicians are given to great hyperbole, and I'm certainly not innocent of that crime. But I would argue that this is the most fundamental and profound change in American history since, or the history of the world, since either the printing press invention or the Industrial Revolution. And I'm not sure which, and I'm not sure it may be some combination of the two. And one of the things that's so exciting and intriguing about this revolution is that nobody really knows where it's all going. Issues that I face today were not issues 6 months ago before the Congress of the United States. 6 months ago, issues that we faced are now either resolved or diminished in importance. The breathtaking speed with which this technology is developing is exciting, fascinating, and incredibly challenging. I chair the Senate Commerce Committee, which oversees telecommunications issues. I will freely admit to you, I do not understand all the issues that affect this technology. And every time I have one pretty well figured out, then a technology changes, and then I have to figure it out all over again. The best minds that I can find, I have on the Commerce Committee that advise me. 80% to 90% of my day is spent on telecommunications issues. Remember, the Commerce Committee oversees everything that moves, aviation, railroads, space, sports, everything. They once had a chairman from the state of Washington who was the chairman for 23 years, Warren Magnuson of Washington. The way I figure it out is that every time another chairman died, he took his responsibilities because the Commerce Committee has such huge responsibilities, and I spend my time on most of them on your issues, not only because they're fascinating and intriguing to me, but because of the importance of these issues to the future of the country. I do not know exactly where all this is going. I don't know how great its potential is. But I do know, as I said it when I started, I'm excited to be an American because when I first came to the Commerce Committee in 1987, we would have hearing after hearing and after hearing in front of our economy, excuse me, in front of our committee saying the United States is finished. Some of you may remember those days of yesteryear. We don't make any more television sets anymore. The Japanese have won. Americans are going to end up flipping hamburgers to each other. That was one of their favorite phrases, as you might remember. We've lost. We're going to be a service economy. And why don't we be like the Japanese and have a government that picks winners and losers? We had very credible witnesses before the Congress of the United States that advocated that course in a governmental policy. Thank God. Thank God we had the courage and a president who would who would refrain from embracing what at that time seemed like the way we wanted to go. The issues are multitudinous, as I said, but you know the numbers. E-commerce is expected to multiply 25-fold to $1.3 trillion in 4 years. That's almost a meaningless number because every economic prediction in the last 10 years as to where this is all going has never been at the level it actually came about. But there's a lot of challenges out there associated with what's going on. One of them that disturbs me greatly is the proliferation of pornography. Another aspect of it that disturbs me greatly is all these hate and racist websites that we have that our young people are being exposed to. Some view them as very evil and poisonous effect on young minds. I'm very concerned about some of the consolidations within and mergers within the industry. I sometimes wonder if certain aspects of the industry aren't growing too large. I'm very concerned about the failure of the Congress of the United States to understand these issues. Most of the members of Congress are not computer literate. Most of the members of my committee are not computer literate. So it's pretty hard for people to understand these issues when they don't know how to use a computer. This lends itself to increased influence of special interests. The less knowledgeable members of Congress are about issues, the more likely the special interest and the big money donor is to have influence. And when we passed the so-called Telecommunications Reform Act of 1996, it was one of the most outrageous examples of the influence of special interests in America. By the way, one example, we were supposed to deregulate the cable industry. We did deregulate the cable industry, but we also prevented it from having any competition. And if you haven't checked your cable rates lately, they've gone up between 18% and 23%. So the cable people ended up with the best of all worlds, an unregulated monopoly. And the other examples are myriad. But I also think that we have to, hopefully, we can have an administration that will be more agreeable to, in tune with, the needs of this industry. I grew weary fighting on the floor of the Senate for the moratorium on internet taxation. It took us 3 weeks of debate and amendments on the floor of the Senate to get a 3-year moratorium on internet taxation. I grew weary when it took us 2.5 weeks to do the Y2K product liability bill, which we all know how important that legislation is, not just for your industry, but for all business in America. I think it was tough and too bad that we had to fight for 2 weeks on the floor of the Senate for the expansion of the H-1B visa program, when every industry leader that I talk to says one of the greatest challenges to the further progress of the industry is enough qualified and trained workers, of which the long-term solution is our education in America. Our short-term solution, obviously, is that if people are trained and knowledgeable and educated and want to stay and work in America, they should be allowed to. They help America as much as they help themselves. So I think we need to have a government, executive branch, as well as a Congress that's more in tune with these issues. Let me just talk about China and then one other issue, and I'll stop. What happens in China does matter to your industry. What happens in Asia does matter to the American economy. And there are four major challenges to America as we sit astride the world as a superpower has never sat astride the world since the days of the Roman Empire. Those challenges are the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, the means to deliver them, the rise of radical Islamic fundamentalism, the rise of ethnic and tribal strife in places throughout the world, and the emergence of China on the scene as a superpower. They will be a superpower. Question is not whether, question is when. I, of course, and you, I'm sure, are disturbed about the latest exacerbation of relations between our two countries. This administration has conducted a feckless photo op foreign policy for which we may pay a very high price in American blood and treasure in the next administration. Our relations with China are a graphic example of this kind of inconstancy, which has led to us being in a situation where our relations with China have not been worse since 1973. The President of the United States, candidate Clinton in 1992, called the rulers of China the bloody butchers of Beijing. That was his words. In 1998, President Clinton went to Beijing and put his arms around Mr. Jiang Zemin and said he was our strategic partner. They are neither. The Chinese are not the bloody butchers of Beijing, nor are they our strategic partners. For your information, Japan is our strategic partner. But the fact is that after the tragic bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, the president was asked about it at a press conference, and he blamed it on Mr. Milosevic. Next time he was asked about it, he said it was an old army map. When they found out it wasn't the cause of an old army map, in fact, we found out, my dear friends, that there's a store in Washington that you can go to and get a map of Belgrade, and it has the Chinese embassy on it. Maybe that should restore your confidence in our intelligence capabilities. But and then he went to China and visited, and in 9 days in China, he spent 3 hours with the president of China. All the rest was photo ops. My friends, we must support the One China policy. I will continue to do that. At the same time, the Chinese leadership must understand that an integral, an essential part of a One China policy is that China is reunified peacefully. And if the Chinese commit acts of aggression against Taiwan, then that will be breaching that One China policy. We must make it very clear generally to the Chinese and very specific publicly, and make it very clear specifically privately, that the cost of aggression against Taiwan would be far higher than any gain that they might accrue in the short term. Back around 1960, those of us that are, there's very few benefits of old age, but you remember, usually, nice thing about Alzheimer's is you get to hide your own Easter eggs. But the fact is that in 1960, we got hung up on Quemoy and Matsu, the two islands, as you know, that the Taiwanese own. We don't want to get hung up on Quemoy and Matsu. We want to make sure that the Chinese understand it is their interest to enter the world stage as a superpower peacefully. We absorb a third of their exports.
And obviously, if there was a disruption in trade, then that would have significant economic effects. Finally, let me talk to you just a minute about my favorite or most unfavorite subject, depending on how you view it. I'm running for president because I want to reform government so that they're in tune with this technology that you are so intimately involved in. Right now, it takes the FCC 2 years to process a wireless patent license request. Meanwhile, Intel makes a chip, loses money for a year, makes money for 6 months, and makes a new chip. We are completely out of tune. We are geared, the government of the United States is geared to the Industrial Revolution, the railroads, the steel mills, and what was the fundamentals of American economy. They are no more in tune. They are completely out of sync with this new technology. I want to reform education. I want to reform the military. I want to reform the tax code, which is now 44,000 pages long, and the latest iteration will add several hundred more pages to it. But we can't reform all of these institutions of government unless we reform the way campaigns are financed. It is now legal in America, my friends, for a Chinese Army-owned corporation with a subsidiary in the United States of America to give unlimited amounts of money to an American political campaign. I ask many audiences, we have great prosperity, our economy is good, this is a wonderful time, as I said, to be in America, but are you proud? Are you proud when the President of the United States treats the Lincoln bedroom like Motel 6 and he's the bellhop? Are you proud when the Vice President of the United States has monks and nuns violate their vows of poverty and pay thousands of dollars so that they can spiritually commune with him? Are you proud when the Republican National Committee just announced a new category of donor to the Republican Party, the Million Dollar Club? I don't think we're very proud of that because I work there and I can tell you that it has a corrupting effect on the way that we do our business in Washington because the special interest rule and the national interest and the public interest suffers. We just passed a $792 billion tax cut, you might remember, and I'd be glad to discuss it with you. But let me tell you this part about it. We put in a multi-million dollar tax break for a company in Delaware that turns chicken litter into energy. Now, I know the issue of chicken litter into energy has been uppermost in your mind. We gave billions of dollars in gas and oil tax breaks to the oil and gas industry. The company that turns the chicken litter into energy is located in the state of Delaware. The chairman of the Finance Committee comes from guess where? The oil and gas breaks were put in by the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. Guess where he lives? My friends, all of those tax breaks and many more, I mean, the list is very long, we're going to take immediately upon the moment that the President of the United States signed these tax cuts. That was the bill. The president's going to veto it, as you know, but that we're going to take effect immediately. There were other provisions in the tax bill, such as reduction of marginal tax rates, elimination of the marriage penalty, and so many other beneficiaries. You know when they were going to take effect? Sometime around the year 2001, 2003, 2005. The special interest tax breaks take effect immediately. The tax breaks for average Americans, we wait a number of years. That's the situation in our nation's capital today. I spoke at a luncheon of all the secretaries of state about 3 months ago in America. They're the ones that conduct our elections. They had completed a study on the 1998 election of the 18 to 26-year-old vote. It may not surprise you to know that the 18 to 26-year-old vote in the 1998 election was the lowest in history. They did focus groups, Democrat and Republican pollster, on these young people. They said, I would never run for public office. Why should I vote? None of you in Washington reflect my hopes and dreams and aspirations. And they also said that we were corrupt in Washington. And that shames me because I believe that public service is the most honorable of all professions. I believed it when I was 17, when I entered the United States Naval Academy. I believe it today. My friends, I don't know if we'll succeed with campaign finance reform. Russ Feingold, you know, it's McCain-Feingold. Poor Russ Feingold has a letters now that he gets, say, Dear McCain. And I don't know if we're going to succeed or not, but I know we're going to try again in October, and I will try again whether I'm elected President of the United States or not, And as President of the United States, I will make it the highest priority because we have to restore some kind of honor and prestige of young Americans of our government in Washington, D.C. I thank you for joining me tonight. I am now prepared to respond to any questions or comments or insults that you might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator McCain, for your remarks. Now, chairing the question and answer portion of the program is Roberta Katz, President and CEO of the Technology Network. Roberta.
Thank you, Denise Carter, our chair this evening. At the request of Senator McCain, we will be taking our questions directly from our audience as well as from the question cards. If you would like to ask the senator a question, please step to either of the microphones located at opposite sides of the ballroom. Please state your question clearly and succinctly.
Or just stand up and shout.
But because we have a limited amount of time for our radio broadcast, we may not be able to get to all of the questions, but we will do our best. Senator McCain, I am sure that we will have a lot of questions, so let's begin. Yes, sir.
Mr. McCain, my name is Drew Clark with National Journal's Technology Daily. With regard to two of your interests, campaign finance reform and getting young people involved in the political process, have you given any thought and what do you think about the prospects of extending voting to the Internet or to other technological mediums as a way of getting young people involved? And secondly, do you have any thoughts on Mr. DeLay's proposal to make sure FCC regulations don't restrict individuals' free speech rights to express support for a candidate, even if they are a small supporter of that candidate?
Thank you very much. I think voting on the Internet will become a reality sooner than we anticipate, like everything else that's happened on the Internet. Obviously, there's got to be some kind of security. There's got to be authentication. But all those are mainly technical details, so I think you're going to see that. In the last 1998 election, there was one state in America where the voter participation went up, state of Minnesota. Jesse, the body, now the mind, Ventura, was elected governor of the state of Minnesota, who, by the way, I have a great deal in common with. He and I were both in the United States Navy. I was a mediocre high school and college wrestler, and I occasionally wear a feathered boa around the house, as he does. Jesse Ventura's people will tell you that they used the Internet to a degree where they believe that they got 60 to 100,000 voters out to vote for Governor Ventura that had never voted before, and they credit the Internet as the vehicle that they used to achieve that. I certainly don't want to harm anyone's right to free speech, but I soundly reject the thesis that money is free speech. If money is free speech in America, my friends, a lot of Americans have no free speech. In 1907, my personal role model and hero, Theodore Roosevelt, after a four-year crusade, was able to outlaw, guess what? Corporate contributions to American political campaigns. Why? Because the robber barons had taken over American politics, the Goulds and the Harrimans and the Rockefellers, etc. In 1947, we outlawed union contributions to American political campaigns. Thanks, in 1974, after Watergate, we enacted other reform. Thanks to a whole lot of things, which I won't go into the details, it is now spiraled out of control in a way that our founding fathers never had any idea. And to argue that I'm taking away someone's right of free speech when they take millions of dollars and funnel it into attack ads against somebody in a campaign is dead wrong. And I'm not going to stand for it, and I don't think the American people should stand for it. And I soundly reject the thesis that Teddy Roosevelt and those leaders in 1947 and 1974 were out to take away anybody's free speech. And I'll tell you what it is, my friend. It's an incumbency protection racket is what it is today, because most of this money goes to incumbents and keeps them in office. Yes, sir.
Mr. McCain, there's been a lot of news in the media that you're basically running for vice president instead of president. It's my sincere hope that you are running for president.
I thought that was the case of Mrs. Dole.
My question for you is this. If you are president, and when you are president, how are you going to help prevent the thefts in technology coming from mainland China, when China basically has violated every copyright and royalty agreement to date over the past 25 to 30 years. It's mm-hmm. almost like it's a continuing problem, and it's not going away tomorrow or next week, even if they do attempt to close down some of the security leaks here and there.
Thank you, sir. First of all, on the subject of Vice President, I have steadfastly noted, even though I was considered by Bob Dole last time, that I believe that the Vice President has two duties. One is to inquire daily as to the health of the President, and the other is to attend third world dictators' funerals. Neither of those do I find interesting chores. I am not interested in the Vice Presidency of the United States. I would not accept such a thing. I would soundly reject it. I would much prefer to have the influence on the legislative process that I have as chairman of the Commerce Committee. So I hope that puts any of that idle speculation to rest.
Excuse me, sir. Are you saying you would reject the position as Vice President?
Yes, sir. The way that, not the position, the request to be nominated for the job, unless we change the Constitution. I believe that that we have to obviously expect the Chinese to respect our copyright laws, our trade marks, many other intellectual properties that they are in violation of. And by the way, they have made some improvements. I think I can document that. They still have a long, long way to go. I think that the best way that we can achieve that is if China seeks entry into WTO, which, by the way, the President of the United States told the Chinese we would support when Jiang Zemin came to the United States, and then told him just an hour before the press conference that we were not, a very interesting evolution, that would be part of any requirement that the Chinese would have to live up to if we were going to support their entry into the World Trade Organization. And let me just remind you a little bit of history. Every time there's an emerging country on the world scene, Japan is one example, even the European countries back many years ago, they violate things and they don't, and they pollute, and they do a lot of things that we don't want them to do. And with growing economies and a sophisticated and trained and educated workforce and improvements, they get better and better, and they become good citizens. The worst polluters in the world back in the 1950s were the Japanese. And now, obviously, that has changed. So I have confidence that if China chooses to enter the world scene peacefully, that we will see progress in those areas. Thank you, sir.
Senator McCain, I'm a 23-year-old law school student, and I found that few of my classmates are interested in politics and voting. I was wondering why you think that is, and what do you think it's going to take to get young people more involved in our government?
Thank you for the question. First, we have to obviously clean up this system, which has made, according to a Pew Research poll 2 weeks ago, said that 69% of Americans between 18 and 35 feel they are disconnected from government. And the major reason why they said they were disconnected is because of special interest. That's not my poll. That's a Pew Research poll, and that goes along with other polling data that I have seen. So first of all, we have to restore their faith in the system by making sure that they are represented and their hopes and their dreams and their aspirations are. The second thing that needs to be done, I'd like to tell you, about 2 months ago, or a little more than that, Russ Feingold and I were honored with the John F. Kennedy Profiles in Courage Award at the Kennedy Library in Boston, Massachusetts. I seized the opportunity while I was there to go through the Kennedy Library. And I watched a lot of Jack Kennedy's speeches. I'd forgotten how remarkable he was in his ability, I believe matched by Ronald Reagan, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln, in his ability to inspire Americans. The economy is good, things are well, and yet you articulated the view of young Americans right now. There's a certain cynicism and pessimism about America. I believe the job of the President of the United States is to inspire Americans to causes greater than their self-interest. I watched Jack Kennedy's speech on the Peace Corps. It's marvelous. I watched Ronald Reagan's first inaugural speech. I've seen Franklin Delano Roosevelt's speeches. I've read Teddy Roosevelt's speeches. The job of the President of the United States is not only to handle all of the policies and all of that, but it's also to inspire Americans. And every time that your friends tell me, as they do, that there's no great causes left, I say every time, everywhere there's a hungry child, there's a great cause. Every time there's an elderly person without a place to live, there's a great cause. And every time there's a place in the world where people are involved in ethnic and tribal strife and slaughtering innocent civilians, there's a great cause. That's what we need to do for the next generation of Americans. I think I can do it, but I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure that I can. But that's the kind of leadership we need today to remove the cynicism and doubt that you just articulated. I thank you.
Okay, we're going to interject some of the questions that are on the cards. So if you'll bear with us, those of you who are waiting at the mic. This one, and again, this is just reading off the card. At this point, you're a real underdog. What is your strategy for winning the presidency?
Thank you very much. Usually, I'm reminded of, when I look at the numbers that Governor Bush has and the money that he has, I'm reminded of the words of Chairman Mao, who said, it's always darkest before it's totally black. My strategy is simple. Do well in New Hampshire, do well in South Carolina, and that bounce will help in California and the 15 other states on March 7th. This thing is over next. The nominating process is over next March 7th. The day that California decided to move their primary from June to March 7th, it changed the dynamics of the whole electoral process. And it's over on that day. And that makes, believe it or not, New Hampshire and South Carolina more important than less. We used to have a process where you went South Carolina, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Arizona, a series of other states until it stretched out at least well into the month of June or July. Now it doesn't anymore. The second aspect of this that I think is important is that most Americans, thank God, are sane. And a recent poll showed that only 9% of the American people said they were paying attention to the presidential campaign. 9%. I haven't met many in the 9% category. And the fact is that there will come a time in New Hampshire and South Carolina late this year, in the state of California early next year, where people will examine the candidates on their positions, on their record, and on their vision for the future of America. I will do well there. Now, whether I can prevail or not, obviously, I can't say. But there's no doubt in my mind. At this time in 1995 in New Hampshire, Bob Dole had a 35-point lead. Pat Buchanan was at 3. Pat Buchanan won the New Hampshire primary. People begin focusing and concentrating on those. So right now, we're getting organization, raising some money, and doing everything that I wanted to do. For example, in the New Hampshire poll, which is very important, in January I was at 3, we went to 7, to 10, to 13, last week 16 points. Meanwhile, Governor Bush has gone down to 40, Elizabeth Dole has gone down to 7, all the others are in single digits. I'm encouraged by that, but it means that I still have to spend a lot of time in the state of New Hampshire, which I'm very happy to do. And so I'm very confident about how we're going to do. Yes, sir.
Senator McCain, when the current commander-in-chief completes his tour of duty and you become president, how will you go about restoring...
There's my man.
How will you go about restoring the morale of the armed forces, which are pretty sad, the reenlistment rate's down, we are losing pilots? How would you restore that morale and spirit?
Thank you very much. You're right about the condition of the military, and particularly the men and women in the military. Today, this morning in San Diego, I met with members of various service organizations, the USO, the Red Cross, and a number of other organizations. We have a terrible situation in San Diego, and that is that we have literally hundreds of enlisted families who are on food stamps, and some even are homeless. And that has to do with the high cost of living. It has to do with the size of the family and all that. But my dear friends, there are 11,000 enlisted families, proud young men and women today, who are on food stamps. That's a disgrace, and it's outrageous. Now, I enjoy beating up on President Clinton. I'll do it with great regularity. But the Congress bears great responsibility for this. The Congress appropriates the money. The Congress traditionally has been protector of the men and women in the military, and we have miserably failed. So the first thing, obviously, I would raise the pay and benefits of men and women in the military. Second thing I would do is restructure the military. You've got to restructure the military to meet the post-Cold War era situation. And I won't bother you with a whole lot of details, but the best example I can tell you of the problems in the restructuring in the military today, and the best metaphor for it, is the Apache helicopter during the Kosovo conflict. General Clark asked an emergency basis for 24 Apache helicopters to be sent to Albania. It took the Army 10 days to process the request within the Pentagon. It took 2 months to get 24 helicopters from Germany to Albania. Once they got there, they trained, crashed two, and never used it in the conflict. That can give you an indication of how serious the situation is. And finally, look, I'd restructure the military, which the military can't do themselves. I'd raise the pay and benefits. I'd modernize the force. I would stop all this obscene pork barreling that goes on in Congress. I identified $4.5 billion worth of pork in the last defense appropriations bill. It has no earthly connection to defending this nation. The Congress looks at the defense appropriations bill the way that Willie Sutton used to look at banks, and it's disgraceful. So. But there's one other thing. There's one other thing, and this is what I, again, found out this morning in San Diego. When I was in the military and I was somewhere, people used to come up that knew that I was in the military or if I was in uniform, they'd say, thanks for serving. Thanks for fighting the Cold War. Thank you for being a member of the armed forces. They don't do that anymore. Next time you see a young man or woman in uniform in an airport or a restaurant or someplace else, go over there and tell them, thanks for serving and we love you. That makes a difference to these young people, and unfortunately, we're not doing that today. Thank you. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
Senator McCain, you've been quoted extensively in the paper with regard to largely increasing the H-1B visas. And there is anecdotal as well as research information that indicates that people who are 50, the graybeards in our society that are skilled engineers, for every year that they're over 50, it takes them months more to find a job. If that increase is increased a lot more, what role do you think that you would have or the government has in terms of either retraining or ensuring that those people who are dismissed are not just dismissed because they're expensive?
Thank you. The estimates that we have is that between now and the year 2003, there will be 2.6 million jobs created in this industry, and they're clearly not sufficient educated and trained personnel to fill those. The proposal that we have is that every year there will be a survey taken by the Department of Labor to determine whether there is a shortage of or not, and if so, how much. And the proceeds from these H-1B visas will be devoted to job retraining programs. If there are people who are without jobs, I would certainly support retraining, but I would most importantly support them not being fired if they're qualified to hold those jobs. And so I think that if we had a survey taken by the Department of Labor with input from the industry, I think we could resolve a lot of that difficulty that exists. But I don't know of any expert that doesn't believe that there are going to be a huge number of jobs created for which, at least at this time, we are not capable of educating here in the United States of America. Yes, sir.
Senator McCain, you mentioned hate speech and pornography on the Internet. How do you propose regulating or addressing those issues?
Every school and library is going to be wired to the Internet. This is the first real opportunity in American history where we might have the opportunity to realize Mr. Jefferson's assertion that all men and women are created equal. Because for the first time, the kids up in Window Rock and Chinle and Kayenta on the Navajo Reservation are going to have access to the same knowledge and information that the kids in Scottsdale and Phoenix get. As part of that, I have the bill that we're going to pass through the Senate that requires every school and library to acquire software filtering, which would then be used according to community standards. The same way a library board screens printed material that comes into the library according to community standards. I think that that would be an important step forward. The hate speech, the hate information and racist information, I think it's got to be monitored, not censored, monitored But I think more Americans should be made aware, especially American parents, of where this information is and what it means. And finally, Joe Lieberman and I got a bill or amendment passed earlier this year that calls for the Surgeon General to do a survey, like he did, like the Surgeon General did in the early 1970s, to determine the effect of media violence on young Americans. We know it's bad. We don't know how bad it is. And I'm certainly not qualified to make that determination, but perhaps we should get some, so we could get some expert information so that we can do it. I am against censorship. I am unalterably opposed to censorship, but I also want to say one thing about pornography. There's child pornography on the Internet. The United States Supreme Court has decided unequivocally that child pornography does not have any constitutional protection. So the first thing I do is get rid of child pornography off the Internet where it is. And I'd do it with every bit of power that I have as President of the United States, and I'd put every one of them in jail for as long as I could, because I don't think there's anything more disgraceful. I'm sure there may be. I don't think there are many things that are as disgraceful in American society than child pornography. I find it incredibly offensive. Thank you, sir. Yes. Yes, ma'am.
I wondered if you could comment on how, if at all, your experience as a POW has helped you, made you stronger, and in particular, how does it help you in your career in Washington, in dealing with everything you deal with there?
Thank you for the question. I was 29 years old when I was shot down. I was not an 18-year-old draftee. My principles, my ideals, my goals, and my knowledge had pretty well been formulated. So I didn't go through any great metamorphosis when I became a prisoner of war. What it did for me is what you might expect. It helped define and refine my principles. It made me fall in love with America. Obviously, I did not appreciate America until I had been away from her for that period of time. But the greatest honor and privilege that I had was serving in the company of heroes. I was not a hero in prison. I did not do as well as I had hoped that I would. But my great honor was serving in the company of heroes, where I was able to observe 1,000 acts of courage and compassion and love. And the approval of my father and my grandfather and the approval of those I served with is my lasting ambition. So when I am known sometimes for taking on the leaders of my party or my party, it's not my party leaders that I look to for approval, but those who I know are keeping an eye on me. I hear from them almost every day, by the way, that are keeping an eye on me and expect me to act in a way that that will never embarrass them or me. So the effect of any experience that one has is a defining one, and it doesn't have to be a prison experience. Obviously makes one either a better person or a worse person. You don't come out of it in a static kind of situation. I was very pleased and privileged to have, an improving effect on me. That doesn't mean that I haven't done many, many things wrong in my life, and I am far from perfect. All you have to do is ask my children, but I still believe that I have been honored by the experience, and although I don't recommend it, it certainly made me, I think, a far better patriot and a far better public servant than I otherwise would have been. Yes.
Senator McCain, I work in the high-tech industry where much of the workforce is below 30. They don't remember the Vietnam War. They don't remember the gas crisis. They don't understand why everybody wouldn't want to drive an SUV that gets 15 miles to the gallon. And they think that they've made money in the stock market in the past 5 to 10 years because they're really smart, because they've never seen the downside of a business cycle. And they think that the people who've paid into Social Security all their lives really don't deserve to be supported by them because, you know, they're so smart, they're planning for the retirement. What would you say to these people?
I'd say you're a bunch of jerks. This I think this goes back to my previous comment about the job of the president, the mission and purpose of being president of the United States, because these young people that you refer to are the most talented, finest, outstanding young people perhaps that this country has ever produced in an incredibly highly and important technology, which I already rhapsodized about how important it is. But there's got to be somebody to come along to say, my dear friends, there's a lot of people in this country and in this world who are not as well off as you are. And we do owe something to America and to society and to civilization. We do have an obligation. One of the great beauties of the Peace Corps is that people... Have you ever met anybody who served in the Peace Corps that regretted it? Have you ever? Have you ever met anybody who served in the military who regretted it? They might have hated it, but they didn't regret it. And this is this whole concept of calling people to causes. And I don't think we have that in America today. Look, I'm not here to beat up on the President of the United States. He's going to be gone. But everything is so poll-driven. His pollster comes, tells him, says, school uniforms are popular in America. So he gives a speech on school uniforms. Deadbeat dad's picture should be in the post office. So we'll put deadbeat dad's pictures in the post office and fly someplace and have a town hall meeting about it. No wonder Americans are cynical. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be driven on any single foreign policy issue by a poll. And I think that we jeopardize American national security when we do. But I think it requires someone to motivate them. And I believe that given the quality of these young people, that they will respond to the right call, just as other generations of Americans have throughout history and has made America the great and unique nation that it is. Thank you for the question.
Sir, I'm deeply concerned over the degree of partisanship that we find in the House and in the Senate. I can't remember a recent public vote where the vote has not gone, with perhaps two or three exceptions, strictly across party lines, and the two parties are fairly evenly divided. I'd like to ask you what you think you could do as president to try to bring about a degree of bipartisanship.
To the point of tedium, I sound like I am on one theme. But the reality is, in Washington, and it wasn't like this when I came to the House in 1983, when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to fight like heck and then have a drink together in the living quarters of the White House, the special interests control both parties. The special interests don't allow us to compromise and come together for the public good. Latest example, HMOs. Everybody knows that patients need more rights that are members of HMOs. I went to this movie, As Good as It Gets, and one of the characters said, I want the right to choose my own doctor. The audience applauded at the movie. So what do we got? We got the Democrats in the grip of the trial lawyers who want everybody to be able to sue anybody for any reason on any occasion. On the other side, we got the Republicans in the grip of the insurance companies who don't want to give people who are members of HMO some fundamental basic rights, which obviously they deserve. So, because that's where the big money is, we won't come together. And I could tell you example after example after example that where we will not allowed by the special interests that control us. Look, when somebody gives six figures, seven figures, I go back to the Telecommunications Reform Act. AT&T in 1996 gave $600,000 to the Republican Party, $550,000 to the Democrat Party. Political schizophrenia? No, I don't think so. They bought access and bought influence, and you have seen the result of that. They keep us gridlocked, and so that we act in the special interest and not in the national interest. The day we have campaign finance reform and we restore power to the people and give people their government back will be the day that you see more Republicans and Democrats working together in America.
How many more questions?
Senator, commentator George Will very recently wrote a piece stating that you had flopped on the issue of abortion and suggested that your position had changed purely to avoid it as an issue outside the Republican Party. What is your position on abortion?
Well, first of all, I'm well known for my flip-flops. But the second thing is that my position on abortion is very simple. I am pro-life. I have a moral belief that life begins at conception. I believe that we should work to repeal any law or any provision that concerning abortion, in my view. But my fundamental point is, and has been for 17 years, an elected official with a pro-life voting record, that we as a party are the party of Abraham Lincoln, and we'd better be inclusionary and include those who don't share the pro-life position, because we, neither of us, neither group, like abortion, and we ought to do everything in our power to eliminate abortion, because no one likes it. And there's room in the Republican Party, we're welcome in the Republican Party, those who don't have the pro-life position. And if that is a statement that Mr. Will or anyone else finds objectionable, then I'm sorry. But I remember what Abraham Lincoln said about our party. I remember what Ronald Reagan said about our party. And I remember our platform in 1980 and 84. And you do too, Roberta. And that's one of inclusion and not one of exclusion.
Senator, what would you do if China invades Taiwan? And a related question, what is your position on Tibet and China's action towards the Tibetans?
We have every right to expect the Chinese to make progress in human rights and towards democracy. If you count Chairman Mao as zero on a scale of 1 to 10, Deng Xiaoping was a 3, these present rulers are a 6 or a 7. We have every right to expect them to get to a 10, but they're not going to do it right away. Russia. The shadow of what happened in Russia hangs over the actions and dictates many of the actions of the rulers of China. They saw what happened when communism collapsed in Russia, and they are scared to death of a repeat of that experience. So I would say that, yes, we have a right to expect improvement in human rights in Tibet, but I don't think anybody expects it to happen right away. If China invades Taiwan, before they invade Taiwan, I would make it very clear, as I said, generally, as I said earlier, there will be a very heavy price for China to pay if they invade Taiwan. Privately, I would be very specific. And I would also, as I said, develop and move seaborne missile defense capability into international waters so to protect Taiwan from missile attack. My friends, this may turn out to be nothing, this situation as it exists today. But it also has the potential to be one of the greatest crises that we've faced since the end of the Cold War, or even in many respects before. I'm not pessimistic. I think the Chinese will realize that it's in their best interest we absorb a third of their exports. It's in their best interest to have a peaceful reunification. But they better have, and they deserve from us, a consistent, focused, clear foreign policy, which we have not had in the past.
Senator, we're down to the last question. If you become president, how would you reduce the size of government, and would you attempt to eliminate any cabinet departments?
The first department of government that I would eliminate would probably be the Department of Energy. I believe that the Department of Energy's responsibilities can be taken over by the Department of Defense, and many of the really terrible things that have transpired are directly the responsibilities concerning these breaches of security are the responsibility of the Department of Energy. I believe that we could reduce the size of the Department of Education, use the Department of Education as a clearinghouse for what works in America, whether it be charter schools or test voucher system or merit pay for teachers or many of the other new proposals that are being tried out in America. And I believe that we could, again, start looking at the FCC. Every time we deregulated an industry, in the case of the airline industry, we did away with the CAB. In the case of the railroads, we did away with the ICC. In the case of the trucking industry, we did away with, I've forgotten the name of the organization. Now that we were supposed to have deregulated the telecommunications industry, the FCC has grown by leaps and bounds. So I would, the next agency of government I would either do away with or dramatically reduce in size and certainly in authority would be the Federal Communications Commission. I answered my last question. I'll be glad to hang around and answer any more questions or comments that you might have. I thank you for your attendance. I thank you for being involved in this industry, which I spoke with such praise and envy, because I'm envious of you to be part of something that really is going to affect not just future generations of America, but the world. It's a very exciting time. All of the people here in Silicon Valley should be very proud of their accomplishments and be very optimistic about the future of the industry, and thereby be optimistic about the future of our economy and our transcendency in the world as we lead the world, both militarily, which is also important, but economically, which is far more important and long-lasting. Thank you for being here. Please remember the words, March 7th is a primary. Remember the words of the late Mayor Daley of Chicago, who said, vote early and vote often. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Roberta Katz, and our special thanks to our guest, Senator John McCain, for joining us here this evening. Our thanks as well to our audience here at the Wyndham Hotel in downtown San Jose. We invite you to join us again soon. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.